At a congressional hearing that spring, Senator Slade Gorton of Washington State pointed out to Exxon's chairman that Japanese executives routinely accepted responsibility for serious corporate failings, no matter the cause, by resigning from their positions. Gorton asked Lawrence Rawl whether he had considered doing the same. Rawl was the Irish-American son of a New Jersey truck driver who had enlisted in the United States Marines, made sergeant, and then became a petroleum engineer at the University of Oklahoma using the GI Bill. He had spent his entire professional life at Exxon. "A lot of Japanese kill themselves as well," Rawl answered Gorton, "and I refuse to do that." Lee Raymond never surrendered his conviction that irrational environmentalists had exacerbated Exxon's problems in Alaska by their opposition to dispersant use, but he did scrutinize the catastrophe for other lessons. One of these was that, no matter what you decide is the right thing to do in terms of trying to deal with the spill, you have to get after it very quickly. The lesson learned here was to try and make sure that there were procedures both in the company and in the respective governments that they knew and we knew that if an incident were to happen, exactly what to do and how to do it. Raymond conceded that the Exxon Valdez episode suggested the need for perhaps a rebalancing of risk-reward in many of our operations. The risks of accidents of the sort that poisoned Prince William Sound that spring and summer of 1989, he said 3 years later, apparently are much higher than anybody in either our company or the industry had envisioned. John Brown, later Lord Brown of Mattingly, joined British Petroleum, as it was then known, in 1966 as a university apprentice. In comparison with Lee Raymond of South Dakota, Brown was an international and cosmopolitan figure. He was half Hungarian, half British. He was born in Germany and spent parts of his childhood in Singapore and Iran. As a young oil executive assigned to New York, he lived in Greenwich Village, taught himself to cook, and spent his spare time at the opera and in Soho art galleries. He was a charismatic young man with floppy ears and a mop of dark hair. As he rose through BP's leadership ranks, Brown began to think that corporations must behave consistently with the will of society, as he put it. He puzzled over what that insight might imply for the internal rules and practices of a large oil corporation. The oil in the holding tanks of the Exxon Valdez had been pumped from Arctic Alaskan fields partially owned by BP. On the morning of the ship's grounding, Brown happened to be asleep at a company base camp on the North Slope, where he had come to say goodbye to colleagues as he departed for a new assignment. At 5 a.m., BP's Alaska general manager woke him up. "We've got a message," he reported. "There's some oil seeping around Valdez. It's from a tanker, and they say it's Exxon's. But no one seems to be doing anything." Brown would recall that he knew right away that something terrible had happened. He boarded a plane and flew over Prince William Sound, home to precious wildlife, where whales would be returning from the warm water in the south soon. As he peered down from above, he could see that the usual white ice floes already were tinged with black. It seemed to him that too little was happening by way of response and cleanup. Where were the response boats and the booms to keep oil off the beaches? In fact, that was a question that British Petroleum's senior executives should have been able to answer. The inadequate response was their failure, too, but it would soon be overshadowed by Exxon's culpability. Brown sensed that the spill's repercussions for the industry would be huge. It was the start of a new chapter. The Exxon Valdez had damaged not just the fragile environment, but also the flimsy trust in oil companies. Environmental groups would have a field day, he expected. Unfortunately, it was no use saying to them that BP was better than its competitors. The industry was now measured by its weakest member, the one with the worst reputation. That oil company was now Exxon. A few days before the Exxon Valdez ran onto Bly Reef, tens of thousands of Hungarians marched through Budapest. The demonstrators turned the commemoration of an 1848 uprising against Austrian rule into a revolt against Soviet-backed communism. Resign, they shouted outside downtown buildings housing Communist Party bureaucrats. Freedom! No more shall we be slaves. They carried flags from Hungary's pre-communist era and demanded the withdrawal of Soviet military forces. Ivan, aren't you homesick? And legal state, not a police state, declared their protest signs. The defiant march added to the cracks spreading that spring through the structures of global politics. The Berlin Wall fell a few months later, in November. The Soviet Union fissured and then disappeared. Democratic and free market revolutions and revivals swept through Central Europe, Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Ethnic, religious, and territorial conflicts, long subdued by the Cold War, erupted one after another. The world was remade, tossed, liberated, and reopened for international business. The Valdez wreck stunned Exxon and its rising leader, Lee Raymond. The disaster would change the corporation profoundly. Internal reforms imposed by Raymond in response to the accident would turn one of America's oldest, most rigid corporations into an even harder, leaner place of rule books and fear-inspiring management techniques. At the same time, Raymond and the rest of Exxon's leaders would gradually pass through the introspection triggered by the Valdez spill and seek out the oil and gas plays that opened so unexpectedly after 1989. An age of empire beckoned America and Exxon alike.